This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Some of the coolest stories in North Carolina's history have actually been forgotten. Like, did you know that the first gold rush in America was in North Carolina? And that some of those gold mines in Charlotte are still there? Just two of the forgotten stories of the state. State's Away Message, it's a podcast, and the highlights are in its second season. Away Message is the podcast. Jeremy Markovich joins me now. He's the host of Away Message. He's also senior editor and writer for Our State magazine, which produces Away Message. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of people don't know about the gold rush in North Carolina. I was surprised to hear it started here. We had the first gold rush.
Yeah, it kind of gets overlooked just because of, you know, everybody knows about the California gold rush. And the California gold rush came a little bit later. It was bigger. It sort of eclipsed the one here in North Carolina. But, yeah, the one here, I mean, it really changed the landscape. And this is before the Civil War. And it led to a lot of gold mining. It led to the U.S. Mint being located in Charlotte, because when you have all the gold, you have to figure out what to do with it, and the easy thing is to make it in gold coins, and you really don't want to travel that far with all the gold you have in your backpack, so you take it to the mint, then make a gold coin, and you're good to go.
Very early 19th century, in fact, late 18th century, right toward the tail end. So how big a deal was it? I mean, it certainly wasn't, as you say, California, but it was a gold rush, right?
Yeah, it was a rush. I mean, you would have a lot of these people kind of showing up, and word spread, and when they had the first gold find, then people heard about that, and they started digging, and they got better at it, and that sort of thing, and soon you had mines popping up in Charlotte all across the Piedmont, and it became this big boom, and I think it brought a lot of interesting characters to town. It brought a lot of foreign investment to town. It was the first big boom in Charlotte.
Well, you talked to somebody named a Reed Gold Mine manager, Larry Reed, and he had some stories to tell, right? Interesting guy.
Yeah, so he took me around. So the place where the actual first find was in 1799, and it was at Reed Gold Mine, which is just outside of Charlotte. It's in Cabarrus County near Concord. And, kid found a nugget in a creek, and it just went from there.
Great story. Let's listen.
And this happened back in 1799 when 12-year-old Conrad Reed, while fishing actually in the creek, discovered this nice, bright, shiny rock. But he didn't know what it was.
And neither did his parents. But the rock did have two things going for it. It was big, and it was heavy.
So they ended up leaving it on their front porch as a doorstop and walked beside this rock for 3 years.
But one day, Conrad's father, John, says, I wonder if this big old rock might actually be valuable. So he takes it to a jeweler, and the jeweler says, John, you got yourself a 22-pound gold nugget. Name your price.
Well, John thought about it, and he finally said, I'll take $3.50, because this was John Reed's farm, and that's how much money he expected to make a week off of his farm. So he figured that was a fair price. Problem was, the nugget was really worth $3,600 then.
That's Larry Neal, manager of the Reed Gold Mine, sharing his story of how the gold rush in North Carolina got started. My guest is Jeremy Markovich, the host of Away Message, a podcast. He's also the senior editor and writer for Our State magazine. So what was the impact on North Carolina?
Well, I mean, the impact of North Carolina is, for the first time, it kind of put Charlotte on the map. I mean, Charlotte was, you know, the story there is that George Washington visited, looked around, said, this is a trifling place, and then kind of moved on. It was always this tiny thing. And the impact was, it made people kind of flock to North Carolina and people from all over the place looking for gold. And the other impact was, you kind of had Charlotte, people digging all over the place, putting mines in everywhere. I mean, there's like a 400-foot deep mine. And these shafts, these mine shafts, tunnels, everything like that, are still underneath the city, underneath Uptown Charlotte, even into South End, underneath Bank of America Stadium, underneath the bank building. So, I mean, it is more than a metaphor to say that literally, the streets in Charlotte were paved with gold, because they had to use the dirt to make the asphalt, and the asphalt every once in a while had little gold flecks in it.
But as you say, nobody knew about this, and even when they were putting in the stadium, they tried to keep this a secret, a great part of the story. Let's listen here. Here's a clip with Mike Sullivan, who's a commercial real estate agent in Charlotte.
They hit some of the mine shafts. They hit some gold. Some of them were fairly extensive with rail cars and such. And they were concerned that the public would find out about it and would slow the process down for the Bank of America Stadium. So they kept it sort of quiet.
So nobody knew about it while they were doing it just because they weren't, you know, amateur prospectors coming out there and looking for gold out there on the construction site.
That's exactly it. And apparently they did a good job because it was several years later and I was talking with someone and they said, oh, we hit a bunch of them. So I was like, really? I never heard of that. And my ear would have been a little more tuned to that than most folks.
That's a clip from an episode of Away Message. It's a podcast associated with Our State Magazine. That was Mike Sullivan, a commercial real estate agent in Charlotte. Away Message host Jeremy Markovich is here. He's talking about the podcast for Our State Magazine. It's almost ironic that this is now the second or sometimes third leading financial capital in America, Charlotte, with Bank of America and all the banking industry having located there.
Yeah, because the interesting thing is you kind of think like, oh, there's this big gold rush here and That is what set up modern-day Charlotte, except no, all the banks, all the mines, everything went out of business. So you know, over time, everything stopped. And so, I talked to a lot of folks in Charlotte and historians are saying, you know, it's kind of easy to try to draw this line, direct line between the gold mining and modern-day banking. Well, all the banks closed. So when banking came along, it's a lot of the modern-day kind of hubris of the people who were the banking folks in the 60s and 70s and 80s trying to compete with the northern banks. That's kind of what led to the boom of today. The gold mining is sort of this interesting chapter that, you know, it's not really connected to the banking, but, you know, you start digging around in Charlotte, you might hit a shaft. You can't get down in there anymore, but if you dig a hole, you're probably eventually going to hit something that you have gold in.
Shafted in Charlotte,
yes.
As they say. Well, and tangentially, the thing that really put banking on the map for made North Carolina one of the leading banking states in the union even more than a century ago was branch banking. It was first legalized in the state of North Carolina, which allowed branches to, you know, we take this for granted now, but if you were the Bank of Boston, you would issue a banknote and somebody in North Carolina would have to trust that that banknote was worth something. Branch banking, which was illegal in most states, became legal here. Banks proliferated, and Charlotte became what it is today. Over time, fascinating stuff. Nothing to do with gold mines, but a fascinating find on your part. Then you found also some research on a story. This is another fascinating story, an episode of Away Message that focuses on a murder case on the North Carolina border. Tell us about that one.
So I first heard about this because I did something that you were not supposed to do when you go online, which is read the comments on a story. I was doing research on another story, and somebody kind of threw out this hypothetical question that was, okay, let's say you are standing in one state. There is somebody standing in another state. You pull out a gun and you shoot that person in the other state. Like, what happens to you? Like, who prosecutes you for the shooting or for murder? Like, what, you know, like, can they arrest you? Like, how do they, like, what happens? Like, and could you get away with it? And the very next comment was, actually, that's not a hypothetical. That happened in North Carolina more than 100 years ago up on the North Carolina-Tennessee border. And once I saw that, I was like, well, I've never heard of this. And I started researching, and it snowballed, and it led me all over the state for, I don't know, I was trying to track down the story for about 2 or 3 months of just trips and research and calls and everything.
Well, now somebody on the comments had heard about this, clearly.
Yeah.
You know. So you go to the, so tell us about it. What, tell us about this murder on the Tennessee border.
So there was a guy named William Hall. He lived out in Cherokee County, North Carolina, which is the westernmost county in the entire state. And he was buddies with this guy named Andy Bryson. And what happened was they went up, they both ran a moonshine still together. And then one day the still disappears. And one guy's like, you took it. No, you took it. They both, you know, mm-hmm. They both get guns. And one guy, you know, swears out a warrant for the other guy's arrest for having a concealed weapon. So they go start hunting him. And they find him up on this trail way up high on this really remote ridge. And they find him, jump out from behind a tree, and shoot him. And from there, it becomes like this crazy case because the next thing that happens is they go on trial. They're obviously guilty of murder. But the lawyers, and the lawyers should get a lot of credit because this is just excellent lawyering. They said, well, you know, we can see where the footprints were, where our clients were standing, and we see where the body fell. And in the couple of feet between them is the state border, which at the time was marked on trees. And they say, you can't charge them in North Carolina. That's, you cannot be murdered in a state that you were not in. So this guy was murdered in Tennessee. Tennessee's problem. And it just kind of went on from there. And the case got kicked all the way up to this North Carolina Supreme Court twice.
Uh-huh. And so how was it resolved?
So the North Carolina Supreme Court first off says, well, yeah, that's a good point. The guy did get murdered in Tennessee, and we looked through all of the laws, and there was no law that specifically addresses this particular situation. So,
what about the folks in Tennessee? Couldn't they arrest him?
Well, they could, and they tried. So they say, okay, you guys are free. And then the second later, they said, okay, we're rearresting you. We're going to send you over to Tennessee to face charges. And so, as they're getting ready to send them over, the lawyers step in again and they say, okay, we've looked at the Constitution, we've looked at the dictionary, we've looked at a lot of these things, and the word fugitive is key here because you cannot be a fugitive. You cannot flee from a state that you have never been in. They said, well, my clients were never, they were, have not been in Tennessee since the crime happened. They weren't there when the crime happened. According to the Constitution, you know, you can return fugitives to the state, you know, to face the crime. Well, they've never been to there, so they can't go there. And this time, it was not as clear-cut, but the North Carolina Supreme Court looked at all of the laws, and they said, yeah, that is true. You cannot be sent to Tennessee. So the guys got sent free. They got, I mean, so they literally got away with murder, and they won at the Supreme Court not once but twice.
Now, this is fascinating, but there's an epilogue to the story because, of course, the extradition piece of this, he's exonerated or never tried because, yeah, you were never here, therefore we can't extradite you as a fugitive. And then he goes to Tennessee.
Why would you do that? I don't. You know, like you would think. And so this is the part that is like it keeps you awake. You're like, you know – you were never going to get the answer, and you're like, oh, like, why did he go to Tennessee? But he did that, and then they arrested him. Finally, the guy who actually sees him in the barbershop that he runs. So he goes to Tennessee, William Hall does, opens a barbershop. One day, the guy walks in, and the guy who walks in is the older brother of the guy he shot. And he says, yeah, I'm going to go get the law, and we're going to bring you to Tennessee. They put him on trial again.
And?
He is found not guilty.
But?
They stacked the jury. So it's,
wow, what a story.
It just goes on and on. There's even more twists and turns to it.
Well, including the fact that his family didn't know anything about this, and yet they had done some extensive research on the family, right?
Yeah, and so they had done the granddaughter had ended up – the great-granddaughter of William Hall had ended up with the family history. And the family history is not like just sort of like, hey, here's a family tree. It's like 12 or 13 books of family history that she had in her basement that she knew nothing about, that she had never looked through them because she just is like, I mean, where do you start?
Right.
So she didn't know anything about it.
Eventually she did. You talked to her about that when she finally figured out the story. Let's listen.
What's going through your mind as sort of you're seeing this stuff for the first time about your great-grandfather?
What went through my mind is that, holy cow, out of 12 or 14 books, I went straight to the right book, to the right page. And that, to me, is not coincidence. That's what went through my mind. Like, I didn't have to shuffle very long. It was so incredible that I even found the right book and the right page to find the right guy immediately. So maybe he's on the other side wanting to be heard.
We don't know which side he's on, but he's on some other side. Donna Hall from the episode of Away Message podcast. I'm here with the founder, the producer of the podcast, Jeremy Markovich. Was it you told her and then she went and looked, or she looked for something else triggered her to go down and look at those books?
Yeah, it was a weird series of phone calls because I finally had tracked down the grandson through – I had done some kind of genealogical research and obituaries and found him, and he's still alive in Florida. He's in his 80s. And I called him up and finally talked to him, and he's like, I don't know who this guy is that you're talking about that you say is my grandfather, but you know, my grandfather I thought was somebody else. You know, his grandma had gotten remarried like three times. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, yeah, call my daughter. And then so I call up Donna, and Donna's like, yeah, I'll go look through the basement for you. I don't know anything about this. Oh, but oh, sure. And then we looked through, and she's like, oh, wow. Like, okay. Like, what? Oh, he was a murderer. Oh, okay. Like, I mean, just like – She had never even heard of all this, and she opens up, and then we're like discovering something together. It's a weird phone call to make when somebody you're like,
wow.
somebody out of the blue calls and just says like, I know something about your great grandfather.
Maybe you didn't know. Head to the basement and find out. Well, here's a story that we all knew quite a bit about, but you followed up on it, and it's fascinating. And these are people who, one of the episodes focuses on a fight between floating homeowners and the Tennessee Valley Authority. Tell us about that one.
So the Tennessee Valley Authority, a big power company run by the federal government that dammed up a bunch of rivers in across the southern mountains to make dams, to make power. So they made all the stuff to win the war, but they also flooded out a lot of people and created a lot of lakes. And on one of the lakes, Fontana Lake in far western North Carolina, they also kind of made the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. They have a national forest that's out there. There's a lot of land that is around it that is sort of public land that you can't build on. You can't have a cabin or a lakeshore or whatever. And so somebody got this crafty idea back in the 50s to, well, if I can't have a cabin on land, what if I just make something that floats and that'll be my spot where I go fish and hang out on the weekend and stuff. And over time, these proliferated across Fontana Lake, across the south, where you have thousands of these floating homes. And the TVA, for a very long time, had sort of, I would say, tolerated these homes being there. They had issued permits. They said, okay, they have to be a certain size. You can't pollute, whatever. You pay fees. And that was all kind of the norm until a couple of years ago when they said, you know, actually, we're kind of done with this. We want to get rid of them. And that set off this whole fight between the TVA and all of these families that had these homes, some of them going back maybe a generation or two, where they had used them and fished on them, and that kind of put them both at odds.
It was part of this argument that, look, you took – this was our family's land going back. You took it, and we understand why, but this is actually our land under there, so we're just taking our land back.
Yeah, and I think the – I mean, the interesting thing about it is that, you know, if you were to the place where I went, there was a couple, the Eric and Laura Sneed, and they live in Cherokee, and they had bought a couple. I think they bought two of them in 2014 and 2015. And so the price that they had paid was, I would say, in the five figures, let's say, mm-hmm. to both pay and then renovate and make them up to, you know, make sure they still keep on floating, because you had to do it's a lot of work. And from where they are, about a half mile away, you can see sort of on a little hillside. Up on that hillside is a $3 million house where the guy comes in by helicopter from Georgia. He's there maybe like once or twice a year. There's no way that anybody local can afford any of this property that is right there on the lake that kind of used to belong to the local folks. So that was kind of an underlying issue between the TVA and the folks that have these homes. I'd say, like, look, other than this, we really can't go out and enjoy the lake.
And while it did electrify the valley, it also did create these opportunities for very wealthy people. So it eventually goes to Congress, and Republican Congressman Mark Meadows from North Carolina took the side of the homeowners, and here he is witnessing. He's his witness now, and he's asking to test. He's questioning TVA CEO Bill Johnson.
You took their land. Now you're trying to tell them to get off of what you took originally. Is that fair?
So I wasn't around when that
Mr.
happened.
Johnson, I know you weren't. Neither was I. But you read, don't you?
Oh, yes, I read.
Did you condemn the land, and
absolutely.
Did you take it?
Absolutely took it to help win World War II. There's
and I'm glad we did.
Yes, sir.
And you know what? The people of Graham and Swain County are glad you did.
Yeah.
And all they want to do is get a little bit of it back.
U.S. Congressman Mark Meadows from North Carolina, TVA CEO Bill Johnson in an episode of Away Message, talking to Jeremy Markovich today. So I don't have too much time left, but how's that resolved, or is that still going on? What's happening?
Well, they won. The homeowners won. I think they got Meadows on the side. They got a couple other Congress people on their side. Probably was a good thing there was an election year, and it was kind of slipped into a law that was signed by President Obama. So they get to stay. There are still a lot of regulations about, you know, how many there can be and what size and the fees and that sort of thing. But for now, it seems like there's a good resolution there that'll probably have to resolve a couple other things.
We've got about 10 seconds left, but Away Message is going on. What should we look forward to?
We're going out to the coast, to a Coast Guard tower off the coast, going out to look for nuclear bombs, going out to check out a civil rights story that everybody has kind of forgotten about.
All right, well, come on back. Jeremy Markovich, host of Away Message. It's a podcast associated with Our State magazine. Jeremy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You can find links to his stuff at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, is the gluten-free organic lifestyle really healthier? We'll look at food myths on the State of Things in just a moment. Stay with us.